Welcome to this podcast from the Business Marketing Club, or BMC. I'm Dave Stevens. I'm a B2B marketer, and I'm chair and co-founder of the BMC. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community network of B2B marketing professionals and people interested in B2B marketing. It's run by business marketers for business marketers. We provide face-to-face and virtual event meetups, training, podcasts, blogs, newsletters, mentoring, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for B2B marketers. And today we have over 1,000 participants across the world. If this is the first time you've joined us, you're very welcome. Check us out at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. If you've been with us before, well, welcome back. It's really good to have you along again. In this episode, I'll be speaking to Jay Ball, the Managing Director of Prolific, all about content quality. Plus Helen McKenzie, Brand and Campaigns Marketing Manager at S&P Global Platts, will talk about good marketing campaigns. Badass Unicorns Alice Tahar will tell us how business marketers can become their best selves. And Russell Goldsmith, the founder of Audia Communications, shares some great examples of business marketing and what he's learned from them. Are you listening comfortably? Then we'll begin. Good content is said to be the key to effective business marketing. But in a world in which we use more and more channels that are hungry for content, how do we maintain the quality of what we produce? I'm joined to discuss quality content today by Jay Ball, who's the Managing Director of Prolific and also at Considered Content. Jay, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave. Good to be here.
So tell us a bit about, I'm not sure whether to ask about Prolific or Considered Content. Why don't you tell us a bit about both?
Okay, I'll do the short overview. Prolific is fundamentally, it's a managed B2B content creation service, and it's part of Considered Content. So Considered Content, I set up 6 or 7 years back, and that really was... and still is focused on probably the slightly more strategic end of B2B marketing. So we do a lot of work around strategy and positioning and messaging and things like that. We create content of all types, pretty much. And we also stitch these together into campaigns that are normally run through some sort of marketing automation system. Now, Prolific is more recent. It's about coming up on a year old, I suppose, and really was to address the request that we got from people who just wanted some good content. They've sorted their messaging, they've got all that sorted, they've got their marketing automation in place, they just need content that is better than the rest, in effect. So really it's around sort of fixing, I guess, three problems. First is the quality problem. A lot of B2B marketers really just struggle to get the sort of quality they want, need, that their customers expect. And whether that's difficulty getting good writers or difficulty with internal resources or what have you. So we've focused in on solving that with super experienced B2B writers who actually really enjoy doing B2B rather than seeing it as some sort of second choice. And then we kind of wrap that with a money back guarantee that, if we don't produce something you're happy to publish, we give you your money back. Second is the hassle problem, that good content just takes a long time, and particularly when it's in-house, it can take a hell of a long time because everybody's got day jobs and they need to do other things. So we've generally got a pretty slick way of doing this. And the last bit of the puzzle really is what we term the PDF problem. So a lot of high value content is produced in PDFs, which is basically sort of printed publications on screen. They are rubbish on mobile. They can't deliver any sort of rich media like video or surveys or quizzes or any of that sort of stuff. And they give a pretty poor insights. So you might know that somebody filled out a form, they downloaded your PDF. You've no idea if they've actually read it Or they've just filed it away for later, or which bits of it they've read, or any of that sort of stuff. So we built this out on a responsive platform, so it plays nice on mobile. We can embed video, animation, all of that good stuff. We can put gating inside it, or gate before it, or not gate at all, and we can track it down to the individual pages, so we know who read what, and which bits they found interesting, which can obviously feedback into our clients' sort of systems and analysis. Okay. So that's it in a nutshell, I guess.
Okay. So the first of the problems that you talked about there was maintaining good quality content. And I think all marketers would recognize that as a problem. But my question to you would be, is it a modern day problem?
I think it's become more of a modern day problem, if that's not hedging it too much. I mean, I've been around doing this for 25 years or so, I guess. And over that time, we've always created content, you know, various types. I think the thing now is that actually there are so many more channels available. Whereas if I think back to early days where I was really focused on tech, and you knew that actually to hit a lot of the audience, you had something in computing and something in computer week. Those days are long, long gone. And so the audience fragment across different sort of channels and platforms and all of that. So that's certainly made it appear like you need to produce sort of 100 times the content they used to. The real question is, do you really need to? So, you know, I'm a huge fan of focus. So, you know, if the 80-20 rule applies and 80% of your impact is going to come from content across sort of 20% of the channels, then focus on the 20% of the channels. You know, you can build out from there later on.
So let me kind of stay with that. So you're kind of recommending a focus for us on specific channels. But is maintaining good quality content important for an organization?
Yes. I mean, yeah, obviously I've got skin in the game, so I'm biased. But what we're really seeing, and particularly more recently, is probably a swing back to things like the importance of building a good brand in the market, something that's distinctive, differentiated, that's customer friendly, that sits you above your massive competitors. I think content has an enormous role to play in that. Good content, obviously. Not the kind of high volume content that's probably been too pushed of recent times, but the kind of content that does get you closer to your customers, that speaks to their issues, that shows your place in their world without conflating everything up to, you know, there's a saying that you can ladder everything up to world peace, you know, and you get this with some very purpose-driven brands now that actually, you know, we're not about selling WAN optimization, we're about celebrating the noble humanity of the human race or something, you know. But getting that level right and showing that, you know, this is where we play in your world, we understand your world, and we're here to help, I think that's a critical role for content. And again, content's a bit of an abused term, but that's a critical role for how content can help you build a brand over time.
Okay. You talked a little earlier on about focusing in on getting the channels that matter working for you from a content perspective. But I'm interested in other advice you might have on how to maintain good quality content.
Yeah, so, I mean, so within the question, there's the idea of sort of maintaining good quality content. You know, my first step is creating good quality content, because that's a bigger problem for most organizations than maintaining it. If you've got the problem of maintaining it, then you're already in a pretty good place. So But in doing that, and probably it's true for maintaining as well, that it really is about sort of creating content that's super focused on what customers actually care about. We can kid ourselves that we understand, but you know, there's been a lot of anecdotal research, around that shows that actually a lot of marketers hardly ever really speak to their customers, and a lot of their agencies hardly ever speak to their clients' customers as well. I'm in probably a reasonably fortunate position, is I do regular interviews with our clients' customers, because I get to ask them the questions that maybe they couldn't or would be hesitant to. I can ask them what goes right, what goes wrong, and what their focus is, with no agenda in terms of actually trying to sell them something. I'm not a business development person at that point. So that focus is absolutely critical to creating that kind of content that's going to resonate in the audience, with audiences. And you know, just by doing that, you can be head and shoulders above a lot of the competitors in many markets. And you know, we've got to bear in mind now that actually the competition, you know, we think in terms of the competition being, you know, our nearest business rivals, but actually the competition for sort of quality and content as far as customers concerned are, you know, things like, you know, Harvard Business Review and Economist. You know, that, you know, that's where the bar increasingly is. It's not, you know, 15 lessons I learned from the songs of Led Zeppelin and how it applies to whatever. Yeah. And that's a big ask, you know. It is difficult to do. I mean, for us, we spend an inordinate amount of time, you know, fostering relationships with great B2B copywriters who also happen to be great business thinkers. You know, it's not enough that they can just, you know, write good copy. They have to be able to understand the context that the client works within. They have to be able to bring an external view, they have to be able to cry bullshit and say, well, actually, that's not the way that the audience would look at this. And that is the foundation pretty much for everything else at that point. We go through a process where we create incredibly detailed outlines for the content that we create. And then we give it to our clients and say, tell us everything that's wrong with this. No blushes. We've got very thick skins, because that radically shortens the time it takes to create a good piece of content. You know, the approach where you rush to first draft and then all of a sudden you're 3 months down the line and you're on draft 25, nobody's got time for that. And it doesn't create great content. It's, you know, pecked to death by ducks, as one of the expressions goes. We try and avoid that too.
So which organizations do this sort of content creation well?
Across the market, you know, I think a lot of the major tech companies actually do a good job. You know, they were first into really prioritizing content, probably because of their history in white papers and things like that. Obviously, all the MarTech vendors got skin in the game and have been very focused on that. Now, whether they are producing the kind of content that others in B2B should is a big question. If I look across the kind of work that we do and the different types of content, which is probably a little bit different than some of the others in the market, and certainly different than the sort of blog first, what I would term the HubSpot model of content. So yeah, one of our clients is a private equity, growth equity firm in the US. And really for them, content is around building reputation. The thing in that market is that actually it's not really about capital anymore. Actually, it's not that difficult to get money if you're a growing business. It's all the other things around that. It's the relationship around that. So the sort of content that we create with them is things like existing interviews with existing portfolio company CEOs. So, you know, I can see that these are people just like me if I'm thinking of partnering with them. It'll be, you know, interviews with staff to show, you know, this is what our people are like, and this is how they think about this stuff. And then there's longer guides to, you know, things like M&A and talent development and all that type of thing. But it's not about high volume. It's not actually about lead generation or demand generation even. It's about helping potential partners sort of road test the relationship before they get started. Then I guess across other sorts of areas, one of the things I would say is that, you know, we think content, and we think content to the outside world, to our prospect base and that type of thing. Actually, some of the most valuable content is often internally facing. So we work with a large cybersecurity company, and actually with them, it was all around creating internal guides to help them talk to their customers in a more, and again, more customer focused way. So we ran a series of workshops with different business units, and then we created a series of playbooks in effect that that gave them everything, you know, from the core positioning to conversation starters, through to objection handling, through to sample copy that they could use in RFPs and that type of thing. And that really was about enabling them to have better conversations at a probably a slightly higher level than they were used to, but that was because that was the strategic aim of the business, really. And then, I guess, finally, working with a company that creates software for around sort of health and safety, it was looking at the rest of the market that was sort of batching and blasting, and still is batching and blasting, sort of traditional sort of this is all about us content, and what we wanted to show was that actually we were closer to the market, we were closer to customers and what mattered to them. So fortunately, when we did this, you could still easily get people around a table in real life. We literally did it about a week before the lockdown in the UK. We got six health and safety professionals to discuss key issues that mattered to them. So that then created a series of videos, and there's 8 in the first season of these. We spent a whole day shooting, and we've got a lot of video content that we can pull on, but it's bringing it around into a good old Netflix style season one. And then we've also created a companion guide on the Prolific platform, which enables us to then bring our clients' view into this, but also enables us to embed some of that video content, and then gives them the intelligence about who's looking at what and that side of things. So that's, you know, it's difficult for me to talk about other people because, you know, there's you really have this problem of looking outside in, and I think even the stuff that kind of wins awards, that actually understanding, did this really deal with the business issue that it was supposed to, or is it just a really well written award entry, is very difficult from the outside.
That's nonetheless a great set of examples you've given us there, Jay. So thank you very much, Jay Ball, MD of Prolific and Considered Content. It's great to hear you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Most definitions of a marketing campaign tend to the general. A marketing campaign, we're told, could be any combination of activities performed by a business in the marketplace. So is there more of an art or science to a good business marketing campaign? I'm joined by Helen McKenzie, who is the Brand and Campaigns Marketing Manager at SNP Global Platts, to help on this one. Helen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Dave.
So first of all, tell us a bit about what SNP Global Platts does.
Of course. Platts is a division of SNP Global, and we're the leading independent provider of information and benchmark prices for the commodities and energy markets. But in short, we're a price reporting agency.
Okay. And your role there, your brand and campaigns marketing manager. So that means you must be able to tell us what constitutes a good business marketing campaign.
Okay, I'll try. For me, that would be a campaign that shows it understands its audience, whether that be an overarching brand reputation campaign, which is the kind of work that I tend to do, or a niche product launch campaign. If you can communicate the value to your customer, you're going to meet your objective, and hopefully you'll then see the return on investment through the results. I also feel a good campaign has to be able to cut through the noise, especially now. And to steal from Simon Sinek, the motivational speaker, I think it's about knowing why you do what you do and being able to tell that story over and above what you do and how you do it. So really considering your purpose in the market. I've just spent the last 6 months moving our reputation activity into a customer mindset, attempting to make our brand far more customer centric. And I believe that it's going to be game changing and shifting what has become quite a dated perception of Platts. But only time will tell, because I'm launching the activity next week.
Oh, you can come back and tell us how it went.
Oh, absolutely, as long as it goes well.
So is all of that saying that it's an art or a science?
I would say that it's both. I think it takes both. There's an art to understanding what is going to cut through and resonate with your audience. But the best campaign results don't come overnight. They're tried and tested, tweaked and optimized to find that sweet spot. So I think that's really, really key. Testing is so often overlooked due to time or budget restraints, but constant tweaking does pay off, because you learn what works for your brand or for your product based on the responses of your specific audience. Once you've learned their traits, you can then implement them over and over again to gain repeated success, or at least that's what I've experienced.
So what does that success look like? What does a business get from operating a good marketing campaign?
I think it's recognition and reputation. If you can create a campaign that people remember, it's that recognition that gives you something to build on to improve and strengthen reputation as you go. So those are the two things that I think are key.
All right. Okay, so let's get practical. Are there examples that you can cite of businesses that do marketing campaigns well?
Yes. From a B2B point of view, I think Hiscox do a fantastic job, and I may be predisposed to their branding, firstly because I used to work in the insurance industry, but secondly because their branding is very similar to S&P Global's with their use of black, red and white, so I'm quite often find myself comparing it, but I think their style is bold and brave and I absolutely love it. One tactic that I think works fantastically for them is their tube adverts. They're really very memorable, and they've been well considered for the audience in terms of how quickly they can be read in situ in order to get the important and memorable information across before ultimately it gets cut off by an inbound train carriage. And I think it's that sort of attention to detail that makes a good campaign, by considering each tactic and how you can make it work for you and work its hardest. From a B2C example, something that's very current, I would say, is that the Waitrose and Ocado split. I didn't realise that they've actually been working together for 18 years. So I've been fascinated over the past couple of weeks watching it unfold in print and on radio and on social media. And the message from Waitrose side is quite clearly and simply, thank you, Ocado, we'll take it from here. And Ocado, we're leaving and we're ultimately taking all the good stuff with us. When I first heard the radio advert, I thought, wow, Waitrose have gone for the jugular here. It is so aggressive, but it's so clever. And then I saw the visual representation in print of the splitting of an avocado and the representation that Waitrose was taking the stone. They're keeping the good stuff. You know, the idea that luxury items can only be bought through Waitrose. And if you want to keep that Waitrose quality, customers are going to have to come to waitrose.com moving forward. But the reality is that Ocado, as the delivery service, own the customer data. So I assume they've been working with M&S, who are their new partners, to build out their food range in order to rival and ultimately match Waitrose. I was interested to try and find Ocado's response, and they have countered, but it's a much softer approach that is very customer focused, but it gets completely washed out by Waitrose's approach. And but if you take a step back again and you look at the John Lewis partnership, which Waitrose is part of, it really isn't in the fittest state. So I think this is quite a tactical move, as they clearly feel that this is one that they need to win. Especially, as I think I read at the weekend, online grocery shopping is up from 5% to 20%. So, you know, it's something that they really want to take back. I'd be very interested to see what M&S come up with, if they bother to wade in on this to promote their new relationship with Ocado. But it's one that I found really, really interesting to watch. And I mean, they've managed to get me to talk about it on a podcast for a good campaign. So it's clearly worked.
It's clearly working. And it feels like that's one that's going to run a bit longer yet. So it's kind of a watch this space.
Sure.
So what advice would you give to those listeners, Helen, who are about to embark on a marketing campaign?
Understand your audience. And what they're going to get out of it. I think it's so easy to end up talking about you and your company and what you do and how you do it, and what you think the benefits are to a customer. But are those really the perceived benefits of your customers and prospects? I think it's especially important for all of us to consider, are those wants and needs things that have changed in our current unprecedented circumstances? So, I think the key piece of advice is know your audience.
That's good advice. Helen McKenzie, Brand and Campaigns Marketing Manager at S&P Global Platts. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I came across my next guest on LinkedIn as she told a truly inspiring story about how she became the best version of herself. I knew straight away that I had to invite her onto the podcast so that she could inspire you as well. So welcome, Alice Tahar of Badass Unicorn.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Welcome to the podcast. So you've got a fascinating company name. What on earth does Badass Unicorn do?
No, I hope that people like it as much as I like it. I think it helps me to stand out for sure, which
definitely,
marketers, is always something that we're trying to do. So Badass Unicorn, there is a reason behind the madness. It's inspired by what individuals can learn about hyper-personal growth from unicorn billion-dollar companies. So I used to work for Deliveroo, and when I was there, I learned a lot about how companies like Deliveroo grow as quickly and fulfill their potential in the way that they do. And I thought, wouldn't it be amazing if we could look at those lessons and figure out what we as individuals or leaders of teams could do to apply some of those lessons to people so that we can emulate some of that success?
Well, that means you're absolutely the right person to ask this next question of then. So how is it that business marketers can become their best selves?
So what I like to do is I like to apply some of the concepts that we apply to businesses onto human beings. So what's important for a business? Well, for a business, it's important to know what their USP is, their unique selling proposition. Well, just for people, it's really important to understand what individually our unique selling propositions are. So Dave, what are you badass out? What do you stand out by doing? What are your super strengths? And how can you then bring that to life even more? Another example would be these types of businesses, the businesses that we really admire, they understand what their value proposition is. What am I all about? What am I there to bring to the world? And how can I communicate that effectively? So likewise, let's apply the same lessons to ourselves. What's my personal brand all about? what are my values and how can I live those more as well? And then kind of lastly, these businesses have big, hairy, audacious goals. You might have heard a BHAG goal used before.
Oh, yes.
Exactly. Well, why can't we take the same conviction, the same big, hairy, audacious goals and apply them to ourselves as individuals? So I talk a lot about what's your 10-year vision, your career vision, your life vision. And with that vision, you can then say, okay, what can I do now, present day, to try and make that dream a little bit more attainable? What small steps can I take towards progressing toward that future?
So that's a great approach. I'm interested from a marketing perspective in some practical examples of the change that we need to make. So thinking of your business USP analogy, if I wanted to work out what a business's USP was, I'd speak to the clients, I'd speak to prospects, I'd look at what else was going on in the market, I'd speak to the employee base of the company to try to understand their perspective. Should I be doing the same thing to understand my own personal value?
I think you're a badass unicorn, Dave. Yeah, you've got it in one. So it's all about doing exactly what you said, taking feedback, the good and the bad, and then acting upon that feedback so that you can be more of the good and less of the bad. It's about understanding what the market needs and what do you have as kind of strengths and things like that that you can bring to the market, maybe in a new way or in a slightly disruptive way. So yeah, it's all about, I think really practical steps, I think I would say to business marketers to think about what their strengths are. And when you think about your strengths, think about what gives you energy. What do you enjoy doing? What's the thing on your to-do list that you actually look forward to on a Monday instead of pushing towards the end of the week, right? And really taking stock and being self-aware about those things or helping your team to figure those things out. And we know that if people are using their strengths, they're going to have 3 times better quality of life. They're going to have 2 times less stress, and they're going to be 6 times more engaged at work. So if we can take those strengths, bring them to life more, we're going to have happier people. We're going to have more productive people. We're going to have people who are doing more of the stuff that they create impact through. So I would really encourage all of your listeners to think about those scenarios of when their strengths are coming to life. And then perhaps think about some ways, talk to their boss, speak to their colleagues about what potentially could I do to bring more of that strength to life.
I guess if I'm seeking feedback on a business, people mm-hmm. tend to be sort of fairly straight, because a business is kind of a thing. It doesn't have emotions to get offended. If I'm looking at feedback for myself, it may be that the people are not going to tell me the truth because they're worried that it might offend me. Are there any techniques that you would suggest to help me get good, honest feedback to help me find my strength?
Great question. So I think you can obviously ask for feedback anonymously. So maybe you ask your manager to do that for you, or I don't know, if you're currently between roles, asking a friend to do that for you perhaps, or a colleague or something like that, or a mentor. So perhaps that would anonymize and then let people be a little bit more open. But I think encouraging feedback about the things that you do well is really important. A performance review or a feedback 360 should not be 59 minutes about all the things that you're rubbish at and 1 minute about all the things that you're good at. It should be that mix of, here are the ways in which you excel, here's how you shine, this is how you really add value. And by the way, it would be even better if you maybe were a little bit better at listening, or you had X, Y, and Z, right? So I think inviting that positive and negative feedback, and when you're the giver of feedback, make sure that you jump in there with some good points, because otherwise people are going to be afraid to ask. And we've all talked about the, I don't want to swear, but the something sandwich. So you put a piece of good feedback, perhaps a piece of slightly knotty feedback in the middle, and then you follow up with something nice as well.
Great advice. So you've persuaded me to go and make my personal search. But how can I help my colleagues or my employees to make this change also?
So do you know what I don't think we do enough of? I don't think we do enough of telling people what we're grateful to them for. So if you see something good that somebody is doing, the greatest gift you can have is to tell them about it. So, oh, Alice, I thought it was really effective in that meeting when you did X. Or Alice, I really valued that post that you shared yesterday. It helped me to reflect. So I think every single one of us has this beautiful gift that we can give to other people in our possession, and it's free. We just have to activate it. And that just means kind of being mindful and opening our eyes to the good and positive things that we see around us and the great stuff that we see our colleagues and friends doing all the time.
You're an absolute inspiration. Alistair Haar from Badass Unicorn, thank you very much. There's some great business marketing out there, and I'm joined now by Russell Goldsmith, the founder of Audea Communications, to look at some of it. Russell, welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Hi, Dave.
So there's some great business marketing. What's caught your eye?
Well, obviously, I mean, I hope this is okay to use this example, because obviously business that I'm doing at the moment is very much around B2B podcasting. And so I wanted to share an example of one of my clients' work, actually, if that's okay.
Of course.
Because this particular example, I guess, proves that you can create a podcast for literally any audience. So one of our clients is Adama Agricultural Solutions. So they provide herbicides and fungicides to farmers. And their target audience is very much arable farmers and agronomists. And you know, if I was to say to you, picture a farmer or a grower in your head, I don't know if the kind of picture you've now got is that kind of classic Farmer Joe with his cap and that kind of stuff. And it might not be someone who you might think of as, you know, a real innovator, listens to podcasts, but crucially, you know, uses all the latest technology, whether it's the kit, you know, on their farms that's self-steering, it's GPS guided, you know, if they use satellite and drone imagery to do their jobs, remote sensing technology, AI learning. So these people are very, you know, at the cutting edge of technology. Mm. But when they're using that technology, the farmer still needs to, you know, even though everything's automated, the farmer still needs to be present, you know, in that tractor cab. And therefore they spend a lot of time in there making sure it works. But when it is working, one thing that Adama recognized is that they've obviously got time in their hands. And so they wanted to give them something to listen to. So we've been working on this project for a couple of years now, but right at the start, we researched what was out there. We looked at what their competitors were doing. We found that there was only like a couple of podcasts at the time in the agricultural environment, and they were, you know, pretty staid. The content wasn't very vibrant. It didn't paint the picture or you know, and they were dull, you know, couple of people sat around a desk reading a script. So we looked at the idea of actually recording this podcast on the farm, create a kind of magazine style show. So it's got a mix of live stuff that we've recorded on the farm with pre-recorded segments, and we've done interviews with technology providers and you know, charities or whatever. But whilst it's audio, obviously it's a podcast, by recording it remotely on the farm, it creates atmosphere. So you hear us walking through the crop fields and stuff with the farm managers and all the noise in the background, which sparks conversation. But we're creating amazing imagery that with all the photos that we're taking for their social media, certainly better than two people sat around a desk going, hey, like that they, you know, when they were recording on their competitor's one. But crucially for them, it's created this kind of sense of community. So farmers are actually asking us to come on the farm and record there. And also the Adama specialists get to spend a whole morning with their clients or potential clients on the farm. So it's, yeah, I think it's a great example of how podcasting can work within a B2B space, no matter who your audience, you know, is.
And what sort of audience response have you had?
It's been brilliant, actually. It's been brilliant from a, you know, building this community. Obviously, you get a mix of feedback in terms of the content, because, you know, we've aimed for like a 40-minute show, and some people have said it's too long. Others have said we want more, you know, so you can never tick every box from that perspective. But I think what's been good for Adama is that they've taken the time to listen to their audience. So yes, it's created leads for their database, but actually what they've looked at is a lot of the intangible benefits. So comes back to this issue of, you know, authenticity. By recording on the farms, it's gone a long way to create this kind of credibility and trust, because we kind of paint these pictures in, you know, for the listener, because obviously, I mean, radio does this as well, but, you know, audio is telling a story. It's very much telling a story. And by being on the farm and, talking about what you can see and hearing the noise and everything, it paints these pictures in the listener's mind. But they really engage with the fact that we're recording at the right point in the right season, talking to people that, you know, are experiencing the things that the listener is experiencing. So that trust comes through. And so, yeah, the feedback's been good in that respect, and it's kind of encouraged them to do more. But I think also the fact that because we record it on these different farms, and therefore the host farmer is very involved in the show, so that develops those relationships beyond the podcast and again builds that loyalty. But similarly, the pre-recorded segments we've done so we've had a company called Small Robots that are changing the way farming is going to be done. And we've interviewed Microsoft and, you know, with their AI technology. And we've talked about various different charities. And so what that's also done is given Adama an opportunity to kind of increase those relationships with them. And they've done some dual marketing around it. So it's helped, you know, the podcast reach a wider audience. So I think overall, the big benefit is this building of a community. That's what's been really crucial for them.
And if you kind of look more generally, and this is going to be a difficult question, because you as you said at the top of this, you produce podcasts for a living.
Yeah.
But could you say that you've learned something from this example that you'll apply to future work?
Yeah. You're always learning on every project. Funny enough, we're doing a series of interviews at the moment with unicorn leaders for a client. So, so unicorn businesses, you know, obviously being those that are now worth $1 billion and or pounds. And one of the first questions actually we ask each of those unicorn leaders is, what mistakes did you make in your previous business that you've learned from and that you're doing, you know, bringing into your current business? And so just working on a project like that has been great, because I get a chance to listen to these incredibly successful people sharing the mistakes that they've made. I guess the learning from the project that we've done is with this particular one is how crucial it is to kind of analyze, you know, don't just jump in and start recording a podcast. It's plan, listen, you know, listen to what's out there. So as I said, we listen to our competitors and yeah, there'll be some good bits that you think we might nick some of that, but there'll be bad bits that you think we certainly don't want, you know, to sound like that. So plan, but continually listen to the feedback from your audience. And then, you know, if you need to iterate, you do so. And I think what's crucial though is making sure how you differentiate from all the other, you know, because it's great, there's so much podcasting out there, it's a growing industry, which is obviously, you know, great from my perspective, but so much sounds the same. So the other thing is, how can you differentiate from what else is out there to ensure that you can, you know, capture that audience?
Russell Goldsmith, founder of Audia Communications, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's it. That's all for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guests, Jay Ball, Helen McKenzie, Alice Tahar, and Russell Goldsmith. And thanks to our technical team from Through the Eye of Scott Jackson, Andrew Gratian, and Josh Bench. Thanks to you for listening. Do rate or review us if you can, and email me at daystevensnow@gmail.com if you'd like to be a speaker or offer feedback. There's more where this came from. Just go to businessmarketingclub.org.uk. I hope to see you again. Thanks for listening.